It's always funny when you say my name, it's like, oh, I have to preach today. That's right. Shalom, Havarim. Hello, friends. Good to see you this Sunday morning or whenever you are watching online. I heard about a group of people this week that have a bit of an issue. And these people have problems with shopping. And it's not like they can't shop. They can't stop shopping. They are shopaholics. They just can't leave the store. They have it a part of their inner being, their humanity, that they must shop 24/7, 365 days a year. And it's absolutely impossible for the managers, for the store owners to even get these people out of the store. They are so dedicated to shopping. It doesn't matter what kind of store it is. It might be a big box store, or it might be a small mom and pop. It might be a grocery store or a warehouse kind of store. These people, if these stores shut down, they will stay there as long as they can. You have to drag them out. I've even heard about some people that won't leave these stores and they want to die in these stores. Their last breath, they want to breathe inside a store. Do you know what you call a person who wants to die in a store, who's willing to die in the store because they enjoy it so much, they put their faith in the store? Do you know what you call that kind of a person? There's a name for it. They're called a wall martyr. If you can come up with a better martyr joke than that, I am all ears. Oh, my friends, yes, today we are talking about the martyrs, not the wall martyrs, but the martyrs. And this sermon series is coming out of a bit of a conviction that I've felt here the last couple of weeks. You see, a few weeks ago, I preached on Jesus' passage in Gospel of Luke, where he says, I did not come to bring peace, but I came to bring division. And he talked about dividing families, even. He's come to divide father from son, mother from daughter. And I interpreted that as saying that Jesus' message will necessarily divide some families. Not that that's his intention. He's not coming to try to divide us up, to break us up. But his message will draw some lines. And I mentioned in that sermon that there are still places in the world today that if you become a Christian, your family very well may disown you. There's maybe even communities here in the United States where you cannot become a Christian without your family saying, you are dead to me. So I started thinking about that a little bit, and I started doing some introspection and thinking about myself. And I asked myself, self, because that's what I call myself. And it's weird to call yourself Kevin. Try it. See, it's weird. I said to myself, self, am I willing to do that? If my faith would come between me and my family members, would I still be a Christian today? And unfortunately, that's a lot harder question to answer than I was ready for. Now, thankfully, we don't have to make those. At least I don't have to make that decision about whether I'm going to follow Jesus or be a part of my family today. But I realized it took me a lot more time to really come up with the right answer. Well, I knew what the right answer was. To come up with the correct answer to that question. So as I started processing this question, I realized that we as Anabaptist Mennonites, people situated within the Anabaptist tradition, have this long history of divisiveness. And I'm thinking specifically of the martyrs, the Anabaptist martyrs, who believed so strongly in things like believers' baptism, that they were willing to lay down their lives for their faith. Just remember some of these numbers. Going back to the 16th century, between 1500 and 5000 Anabaptists were martyred between the years 1527, of the first Anabaptist martyrs, to the year 1614. That's less than 100 years. And I know that's a huge range of martyrs. We don't know exactly the number because there were a lot of different stories coming out of that time. Just why did they kill that person, we don't know. Often killing people in groups. But most estimates say there were about 2,500 Anabaptist martyrs who died for their faith. People who weren't willing to recant or go back on what they believed. They wouldn't say, I am not a Christian, just to save their own skin. They believed so strongly in this that they were willing to lay down their lives. So as I'm thinking about this, I realize that it would be a really cool sermon series to talk about the martyrs. And I know that when you start talking about martyrs, there's kind of this weird like sense like, oh, you're going to talk about people who died. Like, you're going to talk about a lot of gross things and kind of blood and gore. And all at once, all the teens and tweens out there are interested, right? Like, blood and gore? Like, got my attention. It might be a little morose. It might be a little gloomy at times. But what I hope to do is to not emphasize the blood and the gore, but I want to emphasize the faith of the martyrs, the power of their story. And what I want to do is not simply start at the year 1600, you know, or in the 16th century, because there were martyrs well before the first Anabaptists. And there's been martyrs long after the Anabaptists. Well, we still have Anabaptists, but long after those official state-sanctioned martyrdoms ended. So I want to look at some of the older stories from the early church, and I want to look at some of the newer stories from more modern times, and ask how we can gain some sort of confidence in our faith, and our ability to stand up for what we believe today in a world where we don't necessarily have to die for our faith. So what I hope to do for the next couple weeks, and I think we're going to try to stretch this out. And I tell funny jokes, people don't laugh. I talk about scheduling and people giggle. What I hope to do is to stretch this out up until the end of October. Because the end of October, the 1st of November, is All Saints Day. I think it'd be really neat to do this for the next six or seven weeks. And we'll see. I might get tired of it and then come back to it later. And we may have a surprise here in a couple weeks also. But my hope is to look at different martyrs every week. This week we're going to look at two different martyrs. And we're going to connect that to a biblical story. We're going to be asking questions about what virtues can we lift out of this biblical story and also see in these martyrs, and how can we embrace that and take that home as well. So you think we can handle that, at least for today? Yeah. All right. Good, good. We're going to have some interaction. I'll ask you some questions. Feel free to jump in, and we're going to have a good time talking about the martyrs. That's right. So before we actually get into the sermon series, I feel that it's important to know what the word martyr means. Now, the way that I usually use it and the way it's traditionally been used is a martyr is someone who dies for their faith. Has anybody seen the movie The End of the Spear? Nobody at all has seen The End of the Spear. I watched it with you. You can raise your hand. Often when I think of martyrs, I think of missionaries that went into like very rural communities in the bush somewhere, and they were killed because they went in with this message about Jesus. But it's not just the people who went in these communities, not just missionaries. Often we think of these people who had some sort of conviction that they weren't willing to bend on, and they lost their lives, often at the hands of the governing authorities. I'm going to give a hypothetical example here. Children in this congregation, imagine that the government just made this rule that you had to slap your parents. This is the law. You must slap your parents. No, no, it's not official, Ellie. Don't. Where's she going? Turn the other cheek, Tate. Turn the other cheek. But imagine the government made this law that you had to smack your parents on a regular basis. Whenever you greeted them, you had to smack them. And as hard as you can. So this is the law. If you don't smack your parents as hard as you can, they're going to put you to death. It's the death penalty for you if you do not slap your parents. But you know what? You also know the Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments tell you to... Thank you. I came from a child, not even from a parent. To honor your father and mother. What are you going to do? Are you going to slap your parents? That's not bringing them honor. Or are you going to stand up for your faith? And I know that's a weird hypothetical, but think about people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer. We'll probably talk about Dietrich in a few weeks. I call him Dietrich. You know, we're tight. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German pastor and theologian who stood up to the Nazi regime, and he died because he resisted the Nazis. So these are different concepts of martyrs. Now, biblically, the way we get this word martyr, it comes from the Greek word martus. Let's do it. Everybody together. Martus. Martus is literally a witness. As you read through the New Testament in Greek, it's hard to discern just how this word is being used. Especially you get to the book of Revelation, it talks about the martyrs, the witnesses to the shed blood of the Lamb. But the idea here is that a martyr is the best possible witness to the faith. If you are willing to die for what you believe in, others will notice. Now let me ask you a few questions. Who is the first Christian martyr? Or who was the first Christian martyr? Anyone guess? Everybody wants to say Stephen, and I think that's probably a good guess. I think it's possible that Stephen could have been the first martyr. Stephen is the one who early in the book of Acts, he is there and he's preaching, and this guy named Saul is watching over people's coats as he is stoned to death. Stephen is a possible first martyr. Other people would say John the Baptist. Think about John the Baptist. John the Baptist was a follower of Jesus. He was a preacher and a teacher, and he lost his head because he told King Herod that he should not be with his brother's wife. Bible gets a little sketchy there, friends. Other people would say that Jesus himself was the first martyr. He was very political, and he said some messages that weren't agreed upon by the leading authorities, and he was killed for his faith. So it all depends on how you want to argue this, but you get the idea. These different people, because of what they said, what they did, they were killed for their faith. That is a Christian martyr. Well, today let's look at this story that Danny read for us about these two women named Ruth and Naomi. And the story comes to us from the book of Ruth. You got it. All right, the book of Ruth begins by telling that there was this famine in Bethlehem. And this one family gets up from Bethlehem. They go to find some food. They go to a different country. They go to the country of Moab. This family has two boys that grow into men, as boys often do. And in the country of Moab, they find themselves two Moabite women to marry. You hear that? All right, so they find two Moabite women to marry. These women's names are Ruth and, mispronounce it, Orpah. And if I say Oprah today, this is a little known fact, but Oprah Winfrey, her birth name was Orpah. She was named after this biblical character. The kids couldn't say her name. They started calling her Oprah, and that name stuck. Orcah is the... Who would be Orca? That's a killer whale. We love anybody listening at home whose name is Orca. Anyway. So anyway, these boys marry these Moabite women, Ruth and Orpah. Often in English, we anglicize it a bit. Orpah is... Actually, Danny, you have a sister named Orpah, probably named after this biblical story as well. Well, all three men in this family die within a period of 10 years. I don't know what they're doing, what they're feeding these men. just saying. In 10 years, all three of them die, leaving these women all widowed. This is a long time ago, and the women would have had no way to prepare or to provide for themselves. Now, during this time, after these men have passed away, word gets back to Naomi that the famine in Bethlehem is over. So she decides she's going to return to her homeland. And as she's returning to her homeland with these two daughters-in-law, she realizes that things would be better for the two daughters-in-law if they just went back to their homeland in Moab. They would have a better chance of finding new husbands in Moab. They would have family there that could care for them. If they were to escort her, take her, and go with her to Bethlehem, they might all be in the same boat. They may all starve. They would all be at the mercy of Naomi's family. So Naomi says to this daughters-in-law, she says, go home, go back to the Moabites, go back to your people, you will do better there. And Orpah turns and she eventually does go back. But Ruth clings to Naomi, it says, clings to her. And whenever Naomi tries to push her, say, go back, you'll do better for yourself, just return, you'll find another husband. This is Ruth's response. And this is probably one of the most inspirational things that I can read here in the Old Testament. I love this passage from Ruth 1, verses 16 and 17. Ruth says, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you from me. Can you imagine saying that to your mother-in-law? My mother-in-law happens to be here today, so... I won't answer that. I won't even make eye contact with her right now. Like, if I did say that, that would be superiorly awkward, don't you think? Like, everybody else dies. Sue, you and I, we're in it together. Wherever you go, I'm going to go. Your people will be my people. Like, I'd have to cheer for Nebraska or something. I don't know. One more shot there. Anyway, but it shows this deep commitment. But realize that what Ruth is doing here is she's putting her own well-being on the back burner. Like, I think her mother-in-law, Naomi, is right. It would have been better for Ruth to go back to her own people, but instead she presses on with Naomi. And Naomi has really, she says here in this passage too, literally she doesn't have much prospect for a new husband. So whenever Ruth commits to going with Naomi, I don't think that Ruth is doing it for her own good. She's doing it to care for her aging mother-in-law. And there's this beautiful thing because we realize that the Moabites, they were not followers of the God of Israel. The Bible tells us many times that they were idolaters. And I'm not going to get into all the details here, but there was some weird stuff going on in the background of the Moabites. If you know the story, there's kids here. Ask me from another time. I'll tell you about the Moabites and their background. But she makes this dedication that she's going to go with Naomi. She's going to be her friend forever, her BFF. She's going to provide for her mother-in-law, care for her so much that she's going to become a part of her family and she will worship her God. Now, if we fast forward through the story of Ruth and Naomi, we find out that Ruth goes with Naomi and she finds a new husband. She finds this rich landowner named Boaz. They get married and Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz, they live happily ever after. It's beautiful. But you know, Ruth comes up again in the Bible. We find Ruth named in the book of Matthew. And you come to Matthew chapter 1. Anybody here know what you find in Matthew chapter 1? The very beginning of Matthew chapter 1? The genealogy of Jesus. Also known as bedtime material because it will put you to sleep. Generation after generation. I grew up reading this in the King James Version. Much appreciation for the King James Version. Marlene knows exactly what it says. Abraham begat Isaac. Isaac begat Jacob. Kevin became tired. Like, it's like, what is this? For generations after generations. But the thing is, if you take your time and really dig into those genealogies, guess what, folks? That's there for a reason. It is the inspired word of God, and there is something there to glean. And I'm going to get a little off the topic here this morning, but notice this. It says in Matthew 1, 5 through 6, this is the NIV. It says, I don't know if you say it Salmon or Salmon. A little fishy to me. Salmon, the father of Boaz. They just keep coming. Don't even plan it. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Now, if you look at any other genealogies from that time period, you will not find women mentioned. They are patrilineal. They go through the male end of the genealogy. But you notice that just in a couple of generations, we have three people mentioned here. Beginning with Rahab. Rahab was the mother of Boaz. And what do we know about Rahab? She was a Canaanite prostitute. Right, okay. You come to Ruth. And what do we just learn about Ruth? She was a Moabite, so she would have come from this idolatrous background. I'll just use one word quick to give you some sense. Comes from an incestuous background. So you go on a little bit further, and Ruth ended up being the grandmother of King David. Kind of an important dude, right? Yeah, and then go a little bit further, and you find that Solomon was David's son, and his mother was, well, she's not named, it says Uriah's wife. If you remember the story, Uriah's wife was Bathsheba, whom David had murdered so that he could marry his mistress. Remember, all of this, Bible is not PG. All of this is in Jesus' lineage. All of these people are part of his background. We have prostitution, we have incest, we have idolatry, we have murder, we have adultery, all in just a couple of generations right here. And yet in the Bible we have this mentioned. All of these people are a part of David's family. All of them feed into Jesus' lineage. But think about this. If Ruth wouldn't have stuck with Naomi, would we have had a King David? Think about all that went into making this happen. And if you think your family is messed up, remember that you are in good company with Jesus. All right, so that is the story of Ruth and Naomi. Let's pause that for a little bit to tell you about these two women, Perpetua and Felicity. Has anybody ever heard of Perpetua and Felicity before? Okay, so I could tell you whatever I want and you would know no different, all right? So Perpetua and Felicity were early martyrs. They were martyred in the year 203 AD under the persecution of Emperor Severus. And I love this, like, you look at all these patron saints within the Catholic Church, and I really appreciate the Catholic tradition and all, but they have some weird patron saints. They are the patron saints of mothers, expectant mothers, ranchers, and butchers. So, if you go into a Catholic butcher, I guess is a thing, you may find a picture of two women of African heritage. They would have been in Carthage, the northern part of Africa. They are the patron saints of butchers, and I'll explain why I think that is. But the interesting thing about these people, we've got many different stories of martyrs from the early part of the church, but a lot of these stories are just passed on by stories from person to person. And you know, sometimes stories aren't always that reliable. The thing about Perpetua and Felicity, and sometimes you'll see her name written as Felicitas, which is the more Latinized version of it. The thing about these two martyrs is that Perpetua, I pointed the one on the left as if I know which one she is. The thing about Perpetua is that she was a highly educated, noble person. She was able to read and write, and she kept a detailed diary of her life. So she kept all these details about her conversion to Christianity, her persecution, her arrest, her imprisonment, and then other people have filled in the details about her death and martyrdom. And many people have drawn connection between Perpetua and Anne Frank, how Anne Frank wrote down in her diary her experiences of being persecuted as a Jew. So we have more information about Perpetua than we do about Felicity, but I will be able to fill in some of the gaps based on some other writings and pieces from that time period. Okay, so Perpetua, again, we'll imagine she's the one on the left. Perpetua was born into this rich family, and her mother was a Christian, and her father was a pagan. At the age of 22, Perpetua became a Christian. She decided she too wanted to enter into the church. And to become a part of the church, you had to enter into this baptismal class. And it was a very public class because they wanted people to know that they had decided to follow Jesus. The problem was there was extreme persecution during this time period, and Perpetua's father did not want her to die a martyr. So he encouraged her to renounce her new faith, to turn back on what she was now professing to believe. And he kept encouraging her, you have to quit this. You can't go to these classes. You cannot become a part of the church. And in her diary, you find her writings where she writes things like this. She's talking to her father. She says, "You see that pot lying over there? Can you call it by any other name than what it is?" Her father responded, "Of course not." To which Perpetua said, "Neither can I call myself any other name than what I am, a Christian." So Perpetua continues to go to these Bible classes, to this catechism class, the baptism classes, and she's meeting these other people. There are a total of, I think, five people in her class to be baptized. And one of them is this woman named Felicity. And Felicity at this time is 8 months pregnant. Perpetua has a nursing baby back home. Now, we never hear anything about Perpetua's her husband, so we assume that he must have died at some point. But obviously, these two women are drawn to each other. They're the only two women in this baptismal class, and one is a newborn baby. The other one is very much pregnant. Well, eventually, all of these people in this baptism class are arrested, including their instructor. So Perpetua is separated from her nursing child, And Felicity is taken with her, and they are thrown in the same prison, and the three men from their class plus their instructor are in a different prison cell. So at this point, the deacons of the church, they go and they begin to bribe the guards. Total Christian thing to do, right? They bribe the Christian guard. They bribe the guards to give them a better cell and to let them bring the baby to Perpetua, at least so she can nurse it. And as she is there in her prison cell nursing her child, she writes this. She says, "My prison cell suddenly became a palace to me." So Perpetua's parents, her father, keeps coming in and trying to tell her, "You must recant. You must change your mind. You must say you are not a Christian." And even the judge that's hearing their case says, "You know, if you don't do this, if you don't change, you are going to die." And she eventually, she just says, I'm not going to recant. I'm not going to change my mind. I'm not going to change who I am or who I have become." And then the judge has to sentence them to death. So Perpetua, Felicity, and the three other men, one of them died in captivity, are all given this date when they will go in front of an entire crowd in a gladiatorial arena to be mauled to death by animals. It's a way to celebrate the birthday of Caesar. Their death date is set. And when she receives this news, Felicity becomes overwhelmed with sadness. And again, she's 8 months pregnant at this time, probably 9 months pregnant by the time she gets this death sentence. And she's overcome with this grief, but not because she's going to die. She's overcome with grief because she is pregnant and they cannot kill her as long as she is pregnant. And she is afraid that if her friends go before her, they will have to stand alone and die. Felicity mourns the fact that her pregnancy will keep her from dying with her friend Perpetua. Well, Felicity does give birth 2 days before their scheduled execution. And on the day of their execution, they go before the crowd and they're told the story that as they're walking through the crowd and people are yelling jeers at them, they meet people eye to eye in the crowd and they just bless them and they smile to them passing by. They enter into the gladiatorial arena and they are separated, men on one side, women on the other. And the men are gorged to death by bears, leopards, and wild boars. The women are separated and they are to face a wild bull. And this wild bull refuses to gorge them. The bull becomes passive, becomes like a pet to them. And I believe that's why they are the sacred saints of butchers and ranchers or something like that. So as the bull refuses to gorge them, the people ask for leniency. They ask for grace for Perpetua and Felicity. And I imagine the Caesar back there, he does like in Gladiator, you know, thumbs up and down. He is somewhat compassionate to them. Rather than sticking more animals on them, he calls in the gladiators and they are to be beheaded. And as they are standing there together, back to back, side by side, Felicity and Perpetua, these are the last words that Perpetua speaks. She says to the people in the crowd, she says, "Stand fast in the faith and love one another. Do not let our sufferings be a stumbling block to you." Ooh. The gladiator beheads them both, and they die a martyr's death. So obviously there are a lot of differences between the story of Ruth and Naomi and the story of Perpetua and Felicity. Ruth and Naomi did pretty well for themselves. You know, Ruth found a rich husband. I guess that's... it worked out all right, right? And she ended up being a part of the lineage of Jesus. But if we look at the story again, think again about Ruth. She didn't know what lied before her. And she chose to be with her mother-in-law. She chose to be with her friend to support Naomi, not knowing what lie ahead. I think that Felicity and Perpetua tell the same story. And I'm moved by these words of Ruth where she says, you know, "Your God will be my God. Your people will be my God. We're my people. Where you go, I will go." And that commitment to one another as they walk the path leading to God is amazing to me. And it's matched in the words of Felicity as she says, "I am saddened by the fact that my friend may die before me." Not because she wanted to die too, but because she was afraid her friend would die alone. Well, every week whenever I preach a sermon, I try to leave you with some sort of a challenge. I think especially during this series on the martyrs, it's very important to leave you with some sort of challenge for the weeks to come. It's a challenge not only for you, but also for me as well. I simply want to leave you today asking the question, this open-ended question, who is your Ruth and who is your Felicity? Who is it in your life that you can count on traveling with you to a new place just to be there to support you? Who is it that will go with you into the unknown, knowing it may be costly to them just because you are being faithful to Jesus Christ? I don't know who my Ruth or who my Felicity is, but I want to find that person because we need those people in our lives. And not only do we need to have a Ruth or a Felicity, we need to be that for someone else as well. This is my challenge to you today. This will be our challenge for the rest of our lives. May it be so. Amen.